This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Trafford Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Our book today is titled Midwestern Journal, and our author is Howard Doty. Mr. Doty, thank you for joining me today.
I'm glad to be here.
And you're joining me from someplace in the United States near Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Your book has been compared, maybe by error, I don't know, but has been compared somewhat to the writings of Mark Twain. You've written things like this, and I'll compare a couple of quotes that you have written side by side with Mark Twain's, or not side by side, but in comparison. One thing you say, and Pearson's dancing form was as versatile as it was unique. His bottom swore revolution and civil unrest, while the top of him voted Republican. I love the visual of that particular quote. And then you have this other quote that I liked: from the tiny mustard seed comes the mighty oak. Now, Mark Twain, in his writing, said things like, in Paris, they simply opened their eyes, stared when we spoke to them in French. We never did succeed in making them understand their own language. Beautifully turned phrases. And you have written a book, Midwestern Journal, that comes across as being an actual factual journal. But in fact, it is not. It is totally your imagination.
Well, I was first inspired by Mark Twain and his five travel books. The most famous one of those five would be Life on the Mississippi, but the others would be A Tramp Abroad, The Innocents Abroad, Following the Equator, and Roughing It, about his Western adventures during the Civil War time. And I was just in love with his stuff when I read it in college, and there was no other way I could write than to try to imitate him. It was just a natural. So if people says there's a similarity, well, if they say perhaps the reports of Mark Twain's death have been greatly exaggerated, and they're referring to my book, I'm very flattered. Also, my great-grandmother did do a diary, and each chapter of my book is headed with entries from her diary. They're fictional, but she inspired me to do that. And this compares the life as it was lived in the Midwest, back in the 30s and 40s, with it was when the main part of this book was written in the 1970s. And so it's a touchstone with the past, comparing the Midwest as it was then and at another generation.
The subtitle, your main character is Edward Ellis, who's sort of the narrator in your book, or the guy that leads the parade. And the quote there is, the following is from my journal and from the diary of my great-grandmother. Her diary was found in the attic. Mine's going there. So again, turn of phrase is wonderful. I love the imagery you have created. You've also, in your intro, talk about Elmer B. Aldrich. Who was Elmer?
Well, he's a fictional character, but I wrote him in as a great uncle, a offspring of the great grandmother who we talked about.
You have written a book that is appealing from my perspective because I have a sort of a warped view of life, and I'm not saying yours is warped, it's just different. Who do you think is going to enjoy the read?
Well, I think it would be people who like Mark Twain, basically, and he's a humor icon, and so that's encouraging that it turned out to be like him.
You have 195 pages. How did you begin the process? Did you sit down one day and just decided, this is my first book, I'm just going to let it all release, all of my energy, all of my creativity, I'm just going to put it into print? How did you decide to write this book?
Well, I'm not really sure. I wrote it about 30 or 40 years ago.
Okay.
And I kept a notebook of phrases that tickled me, that were similar to Mark Twain. And then as life unfolded in reality, I started to see a chance to put it all together. What's important to me is the symbolism. And that's important to about 1% of the, I think, anybody's readership. But to me, it means a lot. The great-grandmother is a symbol of the Midwest, and she is getting older and dying. And so I just like the symbols that it represents. There's a, in her writings, she talks about her, a noise always coming from her pump house. That would be for the water. Mm-hmm. And that is a symbol of her heart, which again is a symbol of the Midwest. And there's a, at the end, the very last chapter, there is no heading from the great grandmother. She died in the second to last chapter. And so there's a conspicuous void there. But in the main text, Edward Ellis, the main character, is in the cemetery at her tombstone, and a white swan takes off from the cemetery pond, circles around, and flies low overhead, and that swan is the symbol of the great-grandmother. And one, you know, like when you hear mallard or waterfowl fly by, their wings make a pumping sound.
Yes.
And that, again, I don't think anybody's going to get it, but that is a real subtle suggestion or reference to the pump house, the pumping sound that we heard from her journal entries throughout the book.
When you first wrote this and then went back and decided, I think this might be worth visiting again, did you do a lot of editing on it, or was it pretty much a gem in its original form?
I think I did. I'll say that when I finished it, it looked like a aggregate of a bunch of sentences. It didn't seem smooth. But when I came back to it 10 years at a time, and maybe 30 years afterwards, and looked at it, I was amazed at how smooth it ran together. I didn't remember the times when I wrote it and put those sentences together. And so it all came out with time.
Is there a passage that you recall from your book, or that you might be able to reference for my readers or and my listeners at this moment, that might give a better insight into the style of writing you have and your direction as you were composing this work?
Well, I like the one that you mentioned about his bottom swore revolution and civil unrest while the top of him voted Republican.
I love that.
Another one that I think people would like is from the chapter about railroad cars. He used to hop freight trains. Actually, I did too in my real life. But this Edward Ellis would hop freight trains. And here's a three-liner for you. I could feel the draft from the giant rail cars, and I could hear their moaning and rumbling. And all of this started just as quietly and imperceptibly as a campaign for county clerk. The ones that the great-grandmother wrote, I think, I was pleased with those. They're very funny. Like, Fred Haynes had his leg amputated again.
Right.
Or Raymond didn't get up soon enough, so Irene woke him by putting the Doubt's cat on his bed. That worked because Raymond was sleeping with the dog. And yeah. Raymond wouldn't tuck in his shirt, so Mary sewed pink lace on his shirt tails. Raymond is better. Mrs. Banoff called in the AM. Each of her daughters has two fine children, except one who has a boy.
Those are great turn of phrases. Now, do you in real life have that same outlook on life?
Do I?
Yes.
Oh.
Well,
yes.
I have that myself, but my wife feels her mission in life is to explain everything I'm saying. Is that happening in your life as well?
No.
You're very fortunate. You actually can enjoy the journey. Wonderful. Now, this took you over basically a 30-year period. How would you introduce this book to somebody? How would you in a couple of sentences?
Well, it's unique. It's a double diary with a great-grandson and a great-grandmother. And it's just like Mark Twain's travel books in style, so it's enjoyable. One of the reviewers said it was deceptively easy reading. So I wrote it in the style of a person who wasn't very sophisticated, who was just trying his best to learn how to live life.
Now, has anyone else read your book besides you and I and that other individual that you mentioned?
Just the reviewers. I had three reviews. All of them were good. I kind of wondered about this and asked the publisher about that, and they said, well, Clarion review, for example, gave it 4 stars out of 5, and that's in their top 12%.
Fabulous.
And Kirkus Reviews, which is the largest reviewer in the nation, I've seen them on a lot of new books, on the new book stand in libraries, more than anybody else. And they called it thoroughly enjoyable and deceptively easy reading. And but the review I liked the best was by Blue Ink Review. It says it was an intelligently crafted novel. And it is unique. So that's about me. And I take that as a high compliment, an intelligently crafted novel for my first novel.
Beautifully done. Now, besides Edward Ellis and another character named Pearson, are there other characters that are going to stand out to the reader? Maybe a scene that you have created that you think is maybe a highlight scene for you to share?
Can you think of any? I wish you would have mentioned that before because I would have been prepared, but I don't. I can't. Well, is there something that you were thinking about that?
I'm just wondering whether there's a, you know, you talk about the farmer Pearson, and I'm just curious whether in his activities, whether there's anything that really is kind of unique about him besides his
Pearson,
name.
Pearson is a comic fictional person that allows me, as Edward Ellis, that the narrator is Edward Ellis. It allows Edward Ellis to be the straight man and interact with him. And I like Pearson. He has a farm in rural northeast Indiana, and there's one scene I liked where they went to they're in the balcony of the Philharmonic Orchestra concert,
right?
And Pearson, I'll read the three lines here. When Pearson goes to the symphony, he always puts some cotton in his ears to block out the bad notes. If things get worse and more bad notes get into his ears, he will stuff in more cotton until at last perfection is achieved.
Yes, I can
see
that.
That's one of my favorites, and that sums up Pearson a lot, too.
I can see that visually. And
He would favor a concert that was a blank line on the equipment that just, you know, perfect silence rather than bad notes.
Now, in addition to Mark Twain as someone that you admire, were there other artists or other writers or authors that caught your attention as you were going through school?
Yeah, I think the book is similar to Moon River Anthology, which is poetry. Mine is prose, but it's a bunch of small chapters putting together a bunch of short stories. Each one complete in its own chapter. But when you put these chapters together, end to end, they make a bigger story. They're all related.
Mm.
And also, there's a book called Georgia Boy, which nobody knows about, by an author named Caldwell. And that was a bunch of short stories that were like this, that made a bigger novel out of putting together a bunch of short stories together. And Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio, did that too.
Wow. So it's important that our kids, those that have children at home and maybe listening, that they get good influential writers to cross their paths and get involved in literature that may stimulate their creative interests. I think that's a good commendation by itself. Were there other books in the market? You've mentioned a few of them. Are there just a handful that are similar to yours, or do you think yours is unique?
I'd have to say it's unique, the double diary aspect.
Mm-hmm.
The style, Mark Twain did it many years ago, but the double diary is a unique format.
And challenges, were there some in going back and putting this into print?
No.
Was
I can't think. It was so long ago is when I did it.
And it just came together very simply.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff I threw out and put in different chapters, yeah. I got a little more refined as time went by, and I was just playing editor.
I believe this is a fun read, and I would recommend this to my listeners. The title, again, is Midwestern Journal. The following is from my journal and from the diary of my great-grandmother. Her diary was found in the attic, and mine is going there. Those being the words of the narrator of this novel, Edward Ellis. And our author is Howard Dowdy. Howard, where can my listeners get copies of your book?
Well, the usual places.
Places like Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And also their local bookstore if they request it, as well as the online retailers. And you have a website as well?
Yes, Midwestern Journal. That's the name of the book and the name of the website.
Fantastic. Listeners, you can also do a search for Howard Doughty, D-O-U-G-H-T-Y, and find out more details about this beautiful and fun read, Midwestern Journal. Howard, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
For Indie Book Publishing, Trafford Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Six of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Yes, why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear the latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Cross Books. This is J. Douglas Barker. Our book today is titled Anchor in the Past and a Chart for the Future. Our author is Elam McDonald, and Elam is sharing his personal story in this book that's 106 pages or 108 pages in length, and I welcome Elam to the program. Welcome, sir.
Good afternoon, brother.
Good to talk with you. In looking over your story, we have talked about this in the past, but I wanted to share more details about how this story unfolds. In your story, you talk about your family originally was lived in the South, and then moved to Michigan. Tennessee was your birthplace or the birthplace of your family, basically, and you moved to Tennessee. Your father was a gentleman that had, I'll say, high energy and misdirected energy much of the time. Your mom was a lady of faith. And the one question that I didn't ask you before and was curious about, was your mom a lady of faith? Did she have a structural foundation in Scripture and so on when she met your dad? How did that come together?
Well, she has been a Christian all my life. I don't exactly know how old she was when she did come Christian, but Mom lived by the golden rule. She treated people as she wanted to be treated and always was good to people.
Your family was, by description, a family that lived in poverty.
Yes, we did. We were poor, and until the time we went to Michigan, then things began to look up for us.
Your dad began to work as a guard at one of the manufacturers up there. He also, on the side, had an interest in rooster fighting, those kinds of things, activities that would be considered on the edge of the law. How did that impact your family?
Well, the Colt factory was, we was living in the South at that time, and we would go, he would go fight roosters, and I really didn't know as a child whether that was right or whether that's wrong. I just felt like it didn't look right, so I just kept playing and just went about my own business. But it seemed like Dad was always on the edge on things. You never knew what to expect from him from one day to the next, what was going to take place.
And do you think that was part of his upbringing personally that he incorporated into your family structure, or was this something that was just part of his personality?
Well, my brother said that my grandfather used to discipline them that way, that he disciplined us. I don't know. Maybe the older generation did. I can't verify that.
But his discipline was more than just corrective and instruction. It was actually abusive, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And your father...
To me, it was. As far as my dad approached me, it was abusive, yeah.
Yes, and at least it would have been described that way in today's society. You know, my dad was stern with me as well, but I don't consider it abusive, at least in its way it was handled. Your dad, on the other hand, in addition to having a very stern nature and a stern outlook on life and maybe a depressed outlook on life, also was addicted to alcohol.
Yes, he was. He was an alcoholic, and he was trying to quit during the time that we go into the morning of May 2nd, but I don't know what took place for him.
You lived in Michigan for how long before the tragic incident interrupted your family
life? We lived there about 4 or 5 years.
4 or 5 years. And you were 14 years old, and your book title is Anchor in the Past, but A Chart for the Future. Tell our listeners what occurred at the time you were 14 years of age, May 2nd.
1973, yeah, I was 14 years old at that time. And my mother and father's marriage was coming to a climax around that time. And my... Can we go ahead and finish telling the
story? Oh, absolutely. Please tell the story of what took place.
My dad was very abusive to my mother, my brother, my sister, and I. And on the early morning hours of May the 2nd, 1973, I was 14, my father went up to my mother's bedroom. My mother had let him stay the night there at the house with the understanding that he would leave the next day because she was going to get a divorce. But he went up there in the early morning hours of May the 2nd, and he took a baseball bat and busted my mother over the upper face and body. And then he turned and busted my brother's head open. Then he busted my head open. Then he ran us downstairs and trapped me in the kitchen corner. My head was just gushing blood, and I threw my arms up to protect my head. And my dad wound up going back upstairs, and Alan and I, that's my older brother and I, we ran out of the house. And Alan said to me, he said, Dad would kill Mom. And I said, no, he won't. Mom's come through everything else, and I knew she's going to come through this, too. That's what I thought. We went up the road, and the people wouldn't let us in their house at 4 or 5 in the morning with head all bleeding and all that stuff. But they did call the police, and the police in time came by, and they had my dad in the back seat. They took me and put me on one side and put my brother on the other side of my dad. And we drove up the road a little bit, peace, and my dad said he loved us. And my brother said, well, Dad, if you loved us, why'd you do this? He said, I want to save you boys from hell. And I didn't know the love of God at that time in my life. And I said, if he goes to heaven, I'd go to hell. I was very bitter about it. And there was just no way I could forgive my dad. And so we went to the hospital, and they sewed our head up about 7 in the morning. They were two nuns came into the room and started to talk about how good a woman my mother was. And I thought they knew her by her work at the hospital because Mom became an interior decorator and she worked at the hospital at that time. And, I asked, was Mom alive? Cause I wanted to prove Alan wrong. And, the nuns kept talking. Then I asked again, is Mom alive? And they said, no, she isn't. They said, do you want to go see her? And I said, yeah. I remember what went through my mind as I was 14 years old. They had a body with a sheet over it on the table, and they uncovered her upper face and a little bit of her chest. And mm-hmm. I remember her being all bruised up, and I said, Mom, my mind, I said, Mom, wake up and let's go home. But we didn't wake up, and Mom didn't wake up, and we didn't go home. The state of Michigan came and got us, and we became orphans from the state of Michigan.
From there, you traveled or were transferred to Tennessee to live with grandparents.
Yes, my grandparents were an ordained minister and his wife, as well as a pastor of church. They came up and adopted all 5 of us in range from 9 to 16. And I think now what a load they took, but they did it without hesitation. They took on the responsibility of raising the rest of us.
And they decided they needed a station wagon, so they purchased a station wagon because of the growth of the family.
Yes, they. My grandparents said the Lord dealt with them about a week or two before this time to get a station wagon. They thought they would just be picking up people for church and take them to church, but apparently the Lord had different things and new things were going to take place, and I just didn't. They took people to church, but the mission was for us kids.
incredible story to this point. Why did you want to share this story with the world?
Well, the reason why I wanted to share this world is because with the world is because I'm getting older, and I want to leave a legacy of love that Jesus has brought into my life with other people, realizing that God has brought me through this, and he's able to bring other people through what they're going through. And I know he does. It's the process of time.
You didn't think you would live past the age of 18, did you?
No, I didn't think at 16. Mom died when I was 14. I came a Christian when I was 16. I didn't think I'd live to be 18 and have my right mind, let alone I'm 56 now, or this year I will be 56. And I didn't think that God would be that good to me, that he has been that good to me. He gave me a future when it didn't seem like there'd be one.
Were you required to go back and testify at the sentencing of your dad or the court trial?
The subpoenas came out of Michigan in November or December of 73 for Alan, Claire Jean, and I to come back to Michigan to testify against our dad. And I want you to know, going against my dad at I was about 15 here, was not easy because I still feared in some way.
Mm. And in an odd way, you probably underneath, in some way, had a love for your dad.
Yes, I did. It was way down there. It was beyond what I could comprehend at that time, because his incident caused very bitterness in my life.
And what was the result of the trial for your dad?
My dad received a second-degree murder charge, and he spent the rest of his life in prison, and he told the people, the newspapers and stuff, that it got to us what the judge said was, you have deliberately deprived your five children of a loving and dedicated mother. And he said before that he would get sentenced or get probation that he would have to come back before the same judge. And the following years, the judge turned my dad's request for parole down every time it came before him.
And he stayed in prison for how long?
He died being in prison for 30 years in Michigan State Prison in Jackson.
Did you reconcile with your dad?
Yes, I did. What happened is, when the love of God came into my life, at 16, I said, Lord, let me live to tell my dad that I love him and forgive him, because I was just overwhelmed with the love of God. And the first response out of my mouth to the Lord was, let me live to tell my dad I love him and forgive him. Well, as time went on, I forgot about that prayer. I wound up getting married when I was 19, had the first child at 20, then the second child at 24. And in my early 30s, I had a dream that I would see my dad. And I woke up and I was very teed off with God for allowing me to dream such a thing. And I said, God, why after all these years would I have a dream like this? And it was like it cut me right to the heart. I said, Lord, forgive me for how I acted. I wound up talking it over with somebody at work that day. And for the first time, I felt a little love for my dad for the first time since I was a child. But the thought came to my mind to go see him. And I said, God, this is just no way I can do this. This is just too hard. And over the space of the following 3 years, I kept having dreams that I wouldn't see my dad. I talked to Dr. Black at the publishing house where I worked at that time about the dreams, and he felt like God was dealing with me to go see him. And I talked to other people, and they felt the same way. And so after the final dream, about 4 o'clock in the morning, I wrote my dad a letter that I wanted to go see him and send it off. And then and a few days back, I got a response from him that he wanted to see me too. So on May the 4th, 1996, 23 years and 2 days after the death of my mother, I flew to Lansing, Michigan to see my father in prison. I knew that I wasn't that 14-year-old boy looking at my 36-year-old dad. Instead, I was the 37-year-old man getting ready to see my gray-haired, nearly 60-year-old dad. When my dad came into the room at the prison, walking on a cane, the guard pointed his finger at me so my dad would know me, because these years have transpired, and I knew my dad, but my dad didn't know me. I stood in respect as he came to me. I put out my arms to welcome him and let him know I love him and forgive him. I knew that according to the scripture, love is stronger than death. For a while, it was a time stood still. When I got back home, I wondered what else I could do for my father to show him that I love him. My brother and I went to the funeral home and made pre-need arrangements for my father so that when he died, he'd come back to Tennessee. I also planned to speak a eulogy over him when that time came. My brother thought it would be good if Dad could see it before he died, so I sent it to him, my dad. Would you like for me to read it, brother?
Elam, I think it would give great insight into your thoughts at the time of your father's passing. So please share that with us.
This is, I titled it, Eulogy for My Father. I want you to know I spent really quality time in preparing this. I would like to tell you a story about a home where the mother was a rose, and the children's world revolved around her because of the light she radiated. The children loved her with an intense love, and they loved their father as well. Then one day a horrible tragedy took place in the land to the north, which took away the life of the rose and resulting in planting the terrible seeds of hatred in the hearts of the children against the one who had committed the atrocity, their father. The family was shattered. The deed caused the rose of the family to go away, never to return, the children to go south and the father to go further north. Fortunately for the children, they were taken into their grandparents' home and adopted as their own. This let the children know they were loved, accepted, and wanted. They were still family. The second son, which I am, was so filled with rage and bitterness against his father that he said in his heart, if my father goes to heaven, I don't want to go there. I would rather just go to hell instead. So far as he was concerned, his father had died the same night the rose's life had been taken from her. A great war was going on inside this son. He couldn't imagine his life could go on without the rose. But as time went on, the God of heaven, in his mercy, helped the son to realize that it was not his will for the life of the rose to be shortened that way. He also let the son know that if he would live for God, he could see the rose again in a better land and that the rose would be in a perfect state. The son became fascinated with the love of God because never in all his days had he experienced anything like the love of God, not even the love of his mother, who had loved him with all the capability of a human heart. It was at this time that the son prayed to the God of heaven, saying, Lord, let me live to see my father and tell him that I love him and forgive him. As time went by, the God of heaven blessed the son with a wife, children, and property, and he forgot about the prayer he prayed concerning his father. Then one night, the God of heaven gave the son a dream. He dreamed that he had gone to see his father. For some reason, he did not recognize that the dream was from God, and it angered him that God had allowed him to dream it. He had put his father so far out of his mind that the very remembrance of him caused him to demand of God, why did you let me have a dream like that? He even tried to credit the enemy with being the source of the dream. Later, however, as the son pondered the dream and allowed the Spirit of God to soften his heart, he realized that for the first time since he was a child, he felt a love for his father. The thought returned to the son's mind that he should go and see his father. Still, the son battled the impression, telling God, it is too difficult for me again to face my father. I cannot go see my father. But the dreams kept coming, and the Spirit of the Lord kept talking to the heart of the son. If you do not forgive, you will not be forgiven. The Spirit was saying, the son remembered it was the God of heaven who had given him a future when there had not been one. And he also became fearful that if he did not follow the commands of the Lord, he stood in danger of losing his opportunity of life everlasting with the God of heaven, which would also mean that he would miss seeing the rose ever again. So with the encouragement and help of his friends, the son flew from his home in the south to a place in the north where his father was, a place where the son had never been and where he knew no one, but God was with him. When the son saw the father, he put his arms around him and said, Father, I love you and forgive you. For the son, it was as though time stood still. This was the first time he had seen his father since he was a child. The father told the son that he too had came to know the God of heaven. He told the son of the multitude of thorns in his life. These thorns are the trials and prison and stuff that he suffered from doing what he did. Since the terrible time when the rose was taken away, ghost lives were taken away. The father acknowledged to the son that a man must reap what he has sown, and no pence on his part and no good thing he could ever do could take the place of the rose. The God of heaven comforted the father with the knowledge that all have sinned and fell short of the glory of God. But for those who confess their sins, the blood of Jesus Christ cleanses us from all sins. On the strength of the promise of the Scripture and our shared faith in Christ, I say to my Father this day, those who the Son has set free are free indeed. Therefore, I bid you take your flight, and I will see you in the land where all is made new, where the rose will always bloom and the fragrance will be loved, where the time clock of eternity marches on forever, where there will be no more pain, sorrow, in the beautiful city of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. God bless you, and may he keep us all till we reach the city of God. He wrote me back with one of his last requests. It was for him and all his children to enter the house of God again. After being in prison for almost 30 years, on Wednesday, August 13, 2003, my father went to be the Lord, and together his children once again entered the house of God with him.
Fabulous tribute, considering the circumstances, and I think it really recaps the story of your book, your biography, Anchor in the Past, A Chart for the Future. Elam, were there challenges in getting this to print?
Well, I had to relive all the nightmare in my life and stuff, so it took some time to do that. In fact, I took years to develop it and stuff, so it took some soul searching what needs to be spoken, what doesn't need to be, and I tried to go the right balance on words.
Elam, I think you've done a great job, and it took a lot of courage to tell this story, but I think it's one that is important in a lot of areas and on a lot of levels. Again, the story, the biography, is titled Anchor in the Past, A Chart for the Future. Our author, Elam McDonald. Elam, where can our listeners get copies of your book?
Get it at Cost Books, online, Lifeway, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and just about any place that sells books online.
Elam?
Online.
Thank you for sharing your story. Again, Elam's name is spelled E-A-L-U-M, last name McDonald, M-C-D-O-N-A-L-D, if you wish to do a search online to find the book. Thank you, Elam, for joining me today.
Thank you.
For Crossbooks, this is J. Douglas Parker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Boy from Lulu, and the author, Earl Downing, and Earl joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Earl.
Good morning, Steve. How are you this morning?
Doing great, doing great. And what a great story. This is the story of your life. You born during the Depression. Life didn't seem to have much hope, especially when your father threw you out at 13 and you had to go out and figure out how in the world you were going to take care of yourself. We'll get into those details. But you go all the way to achieving professional success, running a $1 million company, your own company. Congratulations, Earl. You're really proof that the American dream works.
Well, thank you, Steve. It does. It just takes a lot of hard work and and being focused on what you really want. Dream big, and you work towards that, and those dreams can come true.
So you've written this book to kind of leave your legacy. Is that the reason?
Yes, Steve. To start with, when I wrote the book, it was started out kind of as a fiction, kind of a drama book that I wrote way long time ago. And Simon Schuster, I talked to them many, many years ago. One of their representatives over in Germany. And I showed it to him, and he says, you know, if you finish that book and send it to me, he says, we'll publish it. Well, somehow or other, that manuscript got lost, and I said to one side. And then whenever I hear about, I guess, about 5 years ago, whenever I realized that I was terminal from a COPD, and I said, you know what, I think I'll just go back and finish writing that book, but make it a memoir. A memory of my life. So I went back and I sat down. I had, you know, I'd retired, sold my companies, and sat down and started working on it. And so consequently, whenever I got through with it, everybody says, well, Earl, why don't you send that in and have it published? It's a good story. A lot of people could benefit from your experience. Because remember, part of my experience, Steve, when I was in the business, was training other people. I gave a lot of lectures, I was always a keynote speaker at most of the conventions that I went to. And so I put all these ideas into this book. So everyone said, you know, Earl, you should get it out there and let other people benefit from it. I've always been a motivating man. I've always been motivated from myself because I always knew that the only way to accomplish and acquire anything was to earn it, because you just don't get it by the stroke of a pen somebody giving it to you, because it just don't happen. So I worked hard for many years in the insurance business, and I worked up. Well, I started out actually selling sewing machines. I worked up to be a manager in that, and then I got into the insurance business, and I worked up to be a manager in that. I'm kind of getting a cart ahead of the horse.
Well, Steve, not really, but yeah, let's go back though. Let's go back to your early days. And by the way, I guess we can really say an early happy birthday to you.
Well, thank you. Yes, next, as a matter of fact, I'll be operated on again on my birthday. I was operated on my birthday of last year when they took out malignant melanoma cancer, and it's come back, and I've got to have that took out again next Monday.
Wow. Well, what a birthday.
Yeah, it's, well, at least it keeps me alive, and I'm only 80, so I want to keep living on. And
that's right.
I've got a young, beautiful wife, and I want to stick around with her because I don't want to leave my money to somebody else. That's the least of my worry, because we've been married for over 50 years, and she has been my companion the whole time.
Well, good for you, too. Good for you. And so you go back all the way back to your early beginnings, and your father had a drinking problem. What happened? Why did he throw you out?
Well, Steve, it's when I went to school. And education was very important to me, and I was in the eighth grade, and I started playing football, and I was doing pretty good in it. And I had a great future in doing that. I wasn't a big man. I'm a small man, but yet I was feisty. I would get in there and hit hard. And my coaches kept saying, well, Earl, if you keep going and playing like you do, you'll wind up getting a scholarship. So I was working hard because my dad wanted me to quit school and start to work and give him my money so he could drink and buy alcohol beverages. So I says, well, I did for a while, and because we was a poor family and we had small kids at home. I had a brother and actually two brothers and two sisters that were still living at home. Two sisters at that time. And so I wanted to contribute as much as I did, but I didn't think all of it should be spent on alcohol. And then when he told me I had to quit school and do as he said, don't put my feet under his table anymore. And I said, I'm not going to do it, Daddy. I said, I just can't see working my hind end off and you taking the money and going and getting drunk on it. So he says, you'll do as I say or you get the hell out. So I got out. So I floated around for a couple of weeks. And then a friend of mine, of us, of the family, seen him and his wife, see me downtown there in Lake City, a little town there close by, and says, what are you doing? And I told him, and they said, you don't lie to him. And he says, look, why don't you come to the house? We think that we can, I can get you a job out there at the sawmill where I work at.
Now, you're 13 at this time.
I'm 13 at that time, just before I turned 14. So I turned 14 working at that sawmill. And I worked at that sawmill until I was 16. I had previously put in for my birth certificates whenever I started getting my Social Security card, but there was no record of my birth because when I was born, I was delivered by a midwife, and she hadn't recorded it properly. So I found out when I went, I was going to join the Army to start with, and they said that I had to have a birth certificate. So that's when I wrote and got the birth certificate. And they said, if you get one, I told them I didn't have one. They said, well, you get someone that will sign an affidavit and take it and have a judge sign it, then we'll, and you get a birth certificate. Well, then you will accept you. Well, they did. I did, rather. And then my mother said, it'll help you. So she, because my mother was probably one of the greatest women ever lived, and she's always interested in her children. She took a lot just to help her children. So I went ahead and got the birth certificate, went back over to join the Army, and there was a sign there that says, the Marine Corps bills men. And I thought, how in the hell do they do that? They cut an arm off here, some people, and the arm there, and paste a leg on and do this. So about that time, some little corporal walked up and he says, can I help you? And I said, no, sir. I said, I'm wanting to go in the Army. But I said, I have to go in the Airborne, but the Airborne, they don't have no vacancies right now. So he carried me in and showed me some pictures of Iwo Jima and Okinawa and all those places. And I raised my right hand and says, yes, I do. So I wound up being at Parris Island, South Carolina, and my drill instructor says, called me a little baby and said, I'll break you before this is over. I know you're not no more than about 12 or 13, but I did look real young. So anyway, I went through the 16 weeks of boot camp, wound up one of two men that made PFC out of boot camp, and went on up to Camp Lejeune, and then I started growing up. That's where they become my mom and my daddy.
Well,
that's where I started learning a few things about life. And then I kind of got on a sidetrack, started kind of partying a little bit. And then I got out of the Marines after the Korean War, and I did go to Korea. I spent 14 months over in Korea. 3 months of that was in combat situation. Then after I got out in 1954, I got a job down in Miami driving a truck hauling topsoil. This didn't offer me no future, so I said, you know what? I'm going to go back in the Marines, and I'm going to go to school, and I'm going to learn something. Well, I did. I went back in the Marines and went to mechanic school. And I spent the next year in being a mechanic. And then by, I don't know how to be truthfully with you, but all of a sudden I wound up, and my CEO had volunteered me for a Toastmasters Club contest speaking. So I spoke for 3 minutes on a matchbox. You ever try that, Steve? Well, I did. And then I wound up being an instructor in the Marine Corps School. I've always had a way of communicating with people, I guess. So,
well, we can tell that.
I wound up being a communicator, teacher. And then finally I got a part-time job when I was stationed over in Hawaii selling sterling silver, crystal, and diamonds. I sold a lot, and I wound up being the number one salesman in that agency, doing this part-time. And I was making more as part-time work than what the Marine Corps was paying me as a sergeant at that time. So I got out and started selling full time. I sold sewing machines, and as I said, I'm back to where I'd begin before. And I sold sewing machines and wound up a manager, and then I got in the insurance business and wound up being a vice president and leading agent in the company just about every year. Was always in the top five. And then after I kind of burned out in that, I had built an agency down in San Antonio, Texas, up to 27 agents. And I was I was the number one agency in the company, but the man over me got a little bit scared. Now, let me back up for just a second. When they appointed me as vice president, whenever they told me how much money I'd be making compared to what I was making as just an agent, I said, no, sir. I said, I'm not going to take a $100,000 a year pay cut just to be a vice president. So I went then. They made me general manager down in San Antonio, Texas, and I built that up to 27 agents. And then they came in and split that, taking 17 of my agents and left me with 10.
Just, Earl, I got to interrupt you because we're going to run out of time, and we've got to know how you built this trucking company. How did that come about? Because this is really quite a huge success story.
Well, with the trucking company, and my wife and I, we had been in Europe for about 15 years selling to the military over the insurance. We came back. I was burnt out. I just absolutely burnt out in the insurance business. And we decided, what are we going to do? And everybody that I went to, and I'm also in a little bit of politics now. George Bush Sr., the old man, mm-hmm. had a program called JTPA. I was 55 years old, and because of that, they sent me to school. The government sent me to school and to learn a new trade. And we chose truck driving. Me and my wife both, we went to truck driving school. And we come out truck drivers, and we went to work for Schneider. And we drove for Schneider at 16 months after we'd been in the business. We bought a truck because I wanted to know what I was doing before I invested any money in it. I bought a truck, and then 3 years later, I owned 16 trucks and a terminal and a five-bay diesel maintenance shop down in Dallas, Texas. And from that, we kept growing and going that's when I was had a gross income of over $1 million a year, and I was very proud. And when I talk to people or they ask me the same question, Earl, how do you do it? Steve, hard work, dedication to what I wanted. I wanted to be successful. I've always been somebody, Steve. I never was a nobody. I've always been somebody. In my mind, I've always been a very, very important person. To me, I have. And to my wife of 50 years, she always thought I was important. She always believed in me. She always gave me support. So with this thought in mind, I built that company. And then when I retired, after doing that for 17 years, I was 73 years old. At that time, we had seen all of Europe. We'd been to Africa. We'd lived on two continents over there. We had traveled all over, and myself, and I'd been all over the Orient, and so we hadn't seen America. So we said, you know what? That's when we decided to get into trucking. And then after we did that, when I was 73, when that happened, and then we sold the company, and I sold my shop down in Dallas, Texas. I carried the paper on that, and then we started going down to Mazatlan, Mexico, and we spent the next 3 or 4 years down there. And then and all of these things I write about in this book. They're all it's covered in this book. What happened down there? And then in 73, I got into karaoke and stand-up comedy. So I was pretty good at it. And in this book, at the back of the book, I tell some of the stories, some of the comedy that I created myself.
Good for you.
And they're a little bit colorful, so when they read the book, they get back to, there's a lot of history in the book. There's a lot of going back, telling about the history of the back in the 30s of black people and white people, their relationship. Steve, I even write in there about an old man when I knew him was 95 years old back in 1937. And he tells what it was like being a slave back when he was a slave. How he had watched his cousin get burned on a stump because he had looked in an outhouse through a peephole. And I write about that in this book, and it made me realize that life can be cruel, but I also, at the end, I come to realize that life can be beautiful. Well, and all we need to learn to do is kind of mingle with each other, get to know each other, understand our cultures are different. Even though we live here side by side, our cultures are different, and we need to understand this.
Well, I think
part of this I learned about culture when we lived in Europe. I had two children born over there, but their cultures are different.
Right.
And I write about that in this book. I try to explain that people are different wherever you go. So whenever I finished that memoir, I sat down and everybody says, Earl, you need to get that on the market.
And you have. And so,
let's get it out there and hope everybody wants to sit down and wants to read it. It's a must-read book. You will not go wrong by reading it.
Well, you're certainly an example of everything that makes America great. We appreciate you sharing with us, Earl, about your incredible life, and doesn't sound like life is anywhere going to, it's going to just keep getting better, hopefully, for you. You deserve every bit of that. So thank you so much for joining us on Indie Book Publishing. Now tell us, how do we get your book, Earl?
You can go online. I have a website. Go online. boyfromlulu.com, Earl Downing. And you can pull up Amazon, Archway, Barnes & Noble, all books. The book is also now being sold in several foreign countries. So if you just go to that website, you can get the book. Can be purchased. A soft cover is $12.99. A Kindle, Nook, or ebook is $3.99. It takes about, if you order the book itself, I believe it's anywhere from two to five days for delivery.
Well, thank you so much, Earl, for sharing with us. And you have a great one.
Thank you, Steve.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Archway Publishing.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.